Test, there we go. Afternoon, everybody. Wow, it's a very exciting conference we got going here. Yeah, well, everybody's playing with their surfaces, not paying attention. Is that... Well, let's try that again. Good afternoon, everybody. Much better. Welcome to Windows Azure Virtual Machines and Virtual Networks. My name is Mark Rusinovich. I'm really pleased to see the room so full. I'm not talking about Windows internals, by the way, just in case you were came to the wrong session by accident or thought that I was going to talk about it. I'm talking about Windows Azure. Just to get a flavor for the composition of the room, how many people have never heard of Windows Azure before? See, that's much better than about a year ago. How many people have played with Windows Azure? How many people have deployed a virtual machine on Windows Azure? How many people have deployed a virtual machine at all, ever, anywhere? Okay, that's just wanted everybody to raise their hand. So this session is a 60-minute quick overview of a bunch of features that we preview released in June that include virtual machines. I'm going to talk about how virtual machines fits into the overall Windows Azure story, as well as the virtual network enhancements that we made that are applicable not just to virtual machines, but cloud services, but really enable a whole bunch of virtual machine scenarios. And before I dig in, I just wanted to jump in and show you what creating a virtual machine is like in Windows Azure if you haven't done it before. It's actually very simple. And we're going to go to the new portal. We still call this the new portal since the old portal was around for a few years, and the new portal's been around since about June, and you can see that it's... Can you see it? All right, this is my first time to present off Office 2013, and I'm still figuring out. I don't want to do end show. Huh. All right, I think I need to do display settings, swap. Sorry about the hide presenter view there, because it's giving me this artificial view of things. There we go. All right, okay, here we go. There we go, there's the new portal. And the new portal, which you probably saw actually in the keynote as well, whole bunch of different things. What we're gonna be focusing on are a few different tabs here, virtual machines, cloud services, and networks. But to create a virtual machine or to create any resource, you can simply click on new from wherever you are in the portal and select virtual machine. What we're going to do is create one from Gallery. The quick create is a one-page dialog that just gives you a few basic settings, like what's the name of the virtual machine. But I'm going to take you down this more advanced path, which will show you some of the more advanced options and choices that you've got when you're creating a virtual machine. Now, we all know what the best operating system on this list is, right? But I'm going to create one of these. How many people like these kinds of virtual machines? Good answer. And we're going to just give it a name, Linux Test. You can see it's asking me for a new username. I can pick one of those. I'm going to go with the default, pick a password, and did I mistype? Pass. Okay, and it'll ask me for the size of the virtual machine. We get the same sizes you get for the PaaS, the Platform as a Service Virtual Machines. It asks me if I want to upload an SSH key. Here, this will come back to the meaning of this dialogue in a bit. This is asking me if I want to create a standalone virtual machine or to add this virtual machine to one that I've already got running. And I'll explain, like I said, in a little bit, what it means to connect to an existing virtual machine, which is this second dialog box. For this, or a radio button, for this, I'm just going to create a standalone virtual machine. Oh, I need to specify a DNS name, so I called it build 2020 Linux, or 2012 Linux, and press next. It's going to ask me about availability sets here. Again, a more advanced concept that I'll get to a little bit later. And that's the last question that we get asked. So that's all it is, a few clicks. Now we've got a virtual machine being provisioned. It'll take probably about 3 or 4 minutes for that virtual machine to be ready for me to SSH into it, and we're going to come back to that and do that a little bit later in the presentation. But that just gives you a flavor for the feature that I'm talking about. We're going to drill now into the capabilities and positioning of this with existing Windows Azure. And for that, this slide gives you a timeline of Windows Azure. How many people were at the PDC when we launched, when we announced Windows Azure back in 2007? So some of you have been back that long. And the interesting thing about Windows Azure, when it launched, it was pure platform as a service play. Not just that, but it was a pure managed .NET code partial trust play. So if you wanted to deploy apps to Windows Azure, you would write a .NET partial trust app and deploy it. Now, that was kind of the vision of the future, make developers' lives easier by putting you in a nice, comfy box where you, it's very hard to make mistakes, making it easy for you to package up your applications and deploy them. The problem was, that we ran into, both internally and externally, as we tried to get people to onboard onto Azure, and people tried to, was that they have lots of existing code that just wasn't compatible with that box that we were trying to put things into. So you can see through the releases over the years that we created what we are now calling on-ramps, which are features that let people bring existing code and existing applications onto Windows Azure. Some of the notable ones in this list are in November of 2009, we introduced full trust, so you could now run, and native code, so you can now bring native Windows code onto Windows Azure. Support for PHP and Java came with that. You can see in November 2010, we added full IIS support. We added things like startup tasks, so if you had code that needed to be configured a certain way, instead of just being xcopy deployed, you could execute that kind of code. But the culmination, the biggest on-ramp, of course, for existing applications is just being able to run those existing applications completely unchanged. And so that's what we released and announced in June of this year as preview Windows Azure Virtual Machines and Virtual Networks. Now, we've always had virtual machines in Windows Azure. When you run a platform as a service app and you deploy your app through Visual Studio, for example, you're deploying it into virtual machines. And those virtual machines are your dedicated virtual machines. You get access to the full box with native code and admin rights, and you can do whatever you want to with them. But there's a key difference between those virtual machines and the virtual machines we actually call virtual machines, if that's not confusing enough. The virtual machines that we're talking about here, one of the ways that I can talk about the differences between them and the platform as a service side of the world is to contrast virtual machines with what we call VMroll, which we also released that into preview about a year and a half ago. VMroll is a platform as a service virtual machine. And the key difference there is that first line there, where it says VMrolls are non-persistent storage, whereas virtual machine roles are persistent storage. What that means is that when you deploy your app into a VM role, the app can go and modify the OS state, it can write settings to the registry, it can create files on the disk, but those are going onto the local server disks in the data center. And if that server fails, that virtual machine role, that VM role, gets reincarnated on another server and has amnesia. It's like it was reborn from birth with a base image, and it remembers nothing of those registry key writes, remembers nothing of those files that it had created in a previous life. And so that is why we call it stateless, a stateless role. And the worker and web roles are also stateless. If you've got state that you want to persist, you externalize it to some durable external storage like Windows Azure Storage or SQL Azure. Now, virtual machines, on the other side, behave like the virtual machines that you run on your Hyper-V platform or your Xen or whatever you want to run on, that are like physical boxes where the operating system and the apps write to the local disk, they write to the registry, and if you shut the machine down, the virtual machine down, or if you move it onto another virtualized server, they reboot it, you reboot it, you'll see that those files and those registry keys are there just as you would expect them to be. And so that is the key difference. We call this persistent virtual machines. So you'll hear sometimes us refer to these things as virtual machines or persistent virtual machines. And then there's some differences with the way that you also give us the images. The key difference here that I'll get into some more detail on is that when you launch one of these virtual machines, you're actually launching with a VHD that's backed in Windows Azure Storage. Whereas when you were giving us a VMroll VHD image, we would import it into an internal store and then run it from there. So a big difference there as well. So that's kind of the difference between IaaS and PaaS. Now, being stateful, there's a lot more responsibility that comes with being stateful. With statelessness, you let somebody else worry about the Einstein, how do I replicate data, how do I make sure that the data is transactionally secure, and you try to stay stateless and asynchronous, and that makes your life easier. Now, we recognize, though, there's a bunch of applications that don't work that way. Applications people want to build apps on. And when especially enterprises want to migrate to the cloud, they want to bring their existing apps as they also move forward into the future with the new apps. By the way, nobody's commented about my cool costume here for Halloween. I'm dressed as a Windows Azure. I was going to go as a rack-mounted server, but my daughter's going as that, so I didn't want to steal that from her. So anyway, these are the features that the key points that we wanted to nail when we set out to develop this feature set spring of last year. So this has been a road that we've been on to introduce this and do it in a way that really cohesively made sense, not just say, oh, here's persistent virtual machines, have a nice day, but that you could actually build stuff with it and run stuff with it and automate stuff with it. So kind of looking at it end to end. IT Pro Experience, and what that means is that you can go to the portal and do what I just did. If you just want to fire up a VM, you can create a VM. You don't have to fire up Visual Studio. You don't have to edit XML to create a virtual machine. To create a platform as a service application, you are a developer. So you are messing with Visual Studio, writing code, packaging it up, and deploying it. It also means heavy support for PowerShell scripting. So all of the interfaces, everything I do today is supported with PowerShell commandlets that you can download from the SDK site. Support for key server applications. When we go to release virtual machines, we didn't want to just say, here's virtual machines, but none of the Microsoft server apps are supported on it. So we worked with the teams in Microsoft that developed these server apps to make sure that they were supported on Windows Azure and that we ran them well on Windows Azure as well. So two things. We needed to run them well, and we needed those teams to say, yes, we support them on Windows Azure. So when somebody calls up and says, this app is not working properly, where are you running it? Windows Azure, that they just wouldn't get hung up on. Third, which they might happen anyway, but at least not for that reason. Easy storage manageability. This is one, how many people have used EC2 and EBS, Elastic Block Store, their backing store for VHDs? So you know that that's like a Roach Motel, where you deploy an image or create a virtual machine in EC2, and now your VHD is kind of in this box that you can't get to. Very hard to extract an image out or to even put images into EC2. We wanted to make our storage solution for VHDs to be very flexible and make it so that you can take things in and out of it very easily, especially important if you're going to migrate workloads from on-premise to the cloud. So we want to make it so you can create a virtual machine on-premise, toss the VHD right up into the cloud easily, or go the other way for DR or for dev test, go create the VHD in the cloud and then bring it back. High availability features means applications. So for platform as a service, you get high availability through the stateless scale-out model. So a worker role or a web role, you just spin out more instances, and they're all clones of each other. So if one dies, no big deal. The load balancer routes traffic to the healthy ones, and it's really easy to create a highly available application. With virtual machines, we had to do some work to bring the properties that we made available for platform as a service to define what is the unit of availability, what is the unit of load balancing into the virtual machine world so that you could do the same things building out a scale-out virtual machine tier and get high availability. Advanced networking means the ability to support networking protocols that server applications use, to be able to use DNS the way that server applications use DNS, and the way ability to be able to connect on-premise to the cloud for those hybrid scenarios, if you've got pieces that you want to run in your own data center, pieces that you want to run up in the cloud so that you can have a secure tunnel between the two. And then finally, we believe wholeheartedly in the future is platform as a service, that we really look at the server stateful development model as the legacy development model. It is very expensive to maintain, very, very hard to scale. When you scale on server applications, you scale up. We mean add more RAM, add more disks. The cloud model for availability and reliability is scale out. So you just add more instances of a building block, and your life becomes a lot easier in scaling. We had, a motto that we used that was very important for us because our developers, as we were developing this feature, they would run into some characteristic of some server application, and they would say, well, those guys work at Microsoft. We can just go ask them to change it so that it'll work on our infrastructure as a service. So we had to say, no, If it requires a developer either to change the application or to modify the application in any way, then it's not infrastructure as a service. Infrastructure as a service means running server applications as is, unmodified. So we would then figure out what we needed to do to support them. As far as the operating system images we support, you can see this reflects what you saw in that picker, that OS picker dialog, as I used the wizard from Server 2008 R2 to Windows Server 2012. We also have images in the gallery with two server applications baked into them so that they're already there for you. You don't have to go download setup programs. And that's SQL Server 2012 evaluation, as well as BizTalk Server 2010 R2 CTP. We also worked with a number of Linux distributors to get Linux onto Windows Azure. This is kind of a hell freezes over moment at Microsoft, running Linux publicly in our own data centers. And we thought that was important because lots of enterprises and lots of developers build stuff on Linux. We didn't want this to be a Microsoft technology-only cloud play. That's not a way that we realize we're going to get significant amount of people. They're just going to say, I've got existing stuff, I've got tools and processes that are built on these open source standards, and so I want to go to a cloud provider that supports those as well. And so we consider Linux as a first-class citizen in the Windows Azure world, and you can see we've got four distros up there, and we're working on bringing on more at the same time. As far as the supported server applications, this is the list that we currently have. We're working with server teams all through Microsoft, and they're in various stages of investigation and certification on Windows Azure. This is the list that we've got right now from SQL Server, Active Directory, SharePoint, and BizTalk Server. This obviously was the order of priority. There's SQL Server, of course. So many applications built on SQL Server, where SQL Azure just doesn't have the features or functionality or performance or scale that some applications need. And so SQL Server was number one priority for us to run well on Windows Azure. And then SharePoint farms. Lots of people build applications, line of business applications, and customer-facing applications on SharePoint. So absolutely had to get Active Directory and SharePoint, which are part of any SharePoint farm. Let's talk about virtual machines and cloud services now, because there's the way that the portal presents things is aimed at somebody that is really just dipping their toes in what Windows Azure Virtual Machines is, and that can lead to confusion later on if you don't understand the distinction between virtual machines and cloud services, because it's easy to think, oh, virtual machines are IaaS, cloud services are PaaS, when that's really not the case. Let's talk first about what is a cloud service from the PaaS perspective. Anybody that's developed an application on Windows Azure, this is what they kind of look like. There's two roles in this particular cloud service. You can think of them as tiers in your multi-tier application. One of these tiers is a web tier. The other one is a middle worker tier. And then you'll externalize your storage to Windows Azure Storage or to SQL Azure, like I said. In those tiers, you create virtual machines, instances, role instances, and you scale out that way, and you also get high availability that way. So those are roles, the tiers are roles, and then the VMs themselves we call instances. And together, they're packaged as a cloud service, which a cloud service is a management, a configuration, a lifecycle, a security, a networking boundary. You can think of it as a container, and really that's the way I think of it is. Cloud service is container, and you put VMs, and eventually you'll put more things, more resources like databases and Windows Azure storage accounts into this container. When you create a virtual machine like the one I just did, let's go see how that's doing. If I go to my virtual machine tab, you can see I've got two Linux tests, and one of these is part of a cloud service. One of them is the standalone one that I just built. So the DNS name that I picked, remember, was build2020-linux. So this one is that the one that I picked? Yeah. So that one is actually not part of a cloud service, whereas the other one is. This one, this build2020-2012 cloud service, if I go look at the instances, you can see it also has a virtual machine called Linux Test. And it shows up as a cloud service. Both of those VMs in there are IaaS VMs, virtual machines. One's called Linux Test. I created it the same way that I created the one at the beginning of the session, except when I got to that page that said connect to existing virtual machine, I said connect to server 2012 16 terabyte. And it, at that point, the hidden cloud service, because every VM is actually in a cloud service, an implicit cloud service, that new Linux one I made in front of you, there is a cloud service there. Its DNS name matches what you saw, which is what I entered in that dialogue, but it doesn't show up in the cloud service page. And that was a decision made by the UX guys to say, somebody coming and create a virtual machine, we don't want to have to have them to understand what a cloud service is and wonder why their virtual machine is now in a cloud service. But it really is. It's just hidden. When you add it to another virtual machine, the way that I did for that other Linux VM I'd previously created, then what happens is that implicit cloud service now pops up in the portal. These cloud services are visible through PowerShell scripts. So the only place this kind of sleight of hand is happening is up in the portal. But so that's just, I just wanted to stop there and make you aware of that. Now, there's implications to being inside of a cloud service that I'll get to when I get to the networking section. Let's talk about images and disks, because one of the things that I picked in that picker was an OS image. That's what we call these images, these VHDs that are generalized, and you can go stamp out VMs from them. We call those images. So you, to create one, you can do a, go through what's called a capture exercise. And we've got other Azure sessions, virtual machine sessions, where they'll show you how to capture a virtual machine, sysprep, generalize it, then capture it, and then it'll show up in your own part of the gallery there in that dialog box, where now you can take your own personalized image and stamp out VMs from it. The gallery, our platform gallery, has those ones that you saw, those Linux distros and those server images. Disks, on the other hand, are the VHDs that were actually specialized. They're kind of instances of images. And if they're OS disks, that means that they were the platform images that VHDs were, or VMs were created on, and those copies of the platform images, when they got specialized, are called disks. So you can think of disks as just disks. Yeah, that's good, just disks. And disks don't have to have operating systems on them. Disks can be data disks. And they're both, from the platform's perspective, just disks. So once you create a VM, like that Linux VM I created, underneath there is an OS disk for that Linux Ubuntu image, specialized. And I can shut down that Linux VM, and then I'll have a disk that has Ubuntu OS on it. And I can then go create another VM and say, here's the disk that I want for that OS, the OS disk. I want it to be this one. And it'll then reboot, and it'll behave the same way that it had previously. Of course, I'll be setting other characteristics as part of creating it, like I'll give it a different DNS name, perhaps. I'll put it in a cloud service, but it'll still be that same disk underneath. As far as the number of disks you can attach to a virtual machine, this is this VM sizing that we've got currently. We're going to be introducing new virtual machine sizes over time. This is what we've got currently, from extra small all the way to extra large. The extra large today, 8 cores, 14 gigs of RAM. You can see everything scales as you go up the size chart, including on the far right, the number of data disks you can attach to the virtual machine. So with an extra large, you can attach up to 16 data disks. I've got a VM, you could probably guess from the name here, 16 terabytes here, that's got a whole bunch of disks attached to it. In fact, it's got 15 data disks attached to it, almost at the limit. So let's RDP into it. And what we're going to do is I'm going to show you that this thing has got 15 terabytes of data disk associated with it. I've got disk management up here. And you can see disk management. I've already formatted them with MBRs. And I'm going to add another data disk to it. And the way that I'll do that is I'll say attach. And if the, all right, network, let's try refresh on that. Attach. Okay, so I can say attach empty disk, or I can attach disk, and I've got some disks laying around. that I created as part of other VMs. These are actually all OS disks that don't have VMs running on top of them right now. So I could attach one of those. So for example, I had a VM that couldn't boot anymore and it was an OS problem. I wanted to fix it offline. I could attach it right there. Or I can say add a empty disk. So we're going to add another disk and we're going to make it the largest size possible. I used to think that 1 terabyte was how many gigabytes? I used to think it was 1.24, but the portal informs me that I'm wrong. So we're going to create a 1 terabyte minus 1 gigabyte disk. And in a few seconds, probably 30 seconds or so, in that VM, what we're going to get is disk management's going to pop up and say, ooh, you got a new disk. So we're going to come back to that in a few seconds. And then we're going to create a giant stripe out of that, so we'll have a 16 terabyte striped disk up in the portal. One thing to note about the disk caching policies. So there's two different caching policies. Again, these are VHDs that are in Windows Azure Storage, and I'll show you very graphically that they're sitting as blobs in Windows Azure Storage. But we cache the OS disk locally on the servers in the data center, and we do that because the OS is very chatty to certain spots of a disk, and we don't want, first of all, you to pay the cost of the transactions back to Windows Azure Storage for every one of those chatty writes to the OS disk. And second, it'll give that kind of workload pattern better performance to just cache them locally on the server rather than having them go to Windows Azure Storage. What we found working with the SQL Server team is that the canonical pattern for people installing server apps is to leave the OS disk alone and then put all the data on data disks. And so the data disk caching policy by default is no caching. So all reads and writes go directly back to Windows Azure Storage. As far as the performance of this, we've worked very closely with the SQL Server team on validating the performance of this solution and making sure that our TPCe numbers and iometer and SQLIO and all of those tests are competitive. And we're still actually making a bunch of improvements. So when you go play with this, go run iometer, go run tests, we actually have a slew of additional performance improvements that we'll be rolling out over the next few months to further improve the performance. So right now you're just looking at a point in time. Again, we're still in preview, and preview is giving us time to learn about what's going on with production and the workload and the reliability and availability and specifically performance to make improvements. But this is an important thing to note because if you put a big SQL Server database on your OS disk and leave the caching policy as is, you might not get great SQL Server performance. To get great SQL Server performance, create a data disk and put it on that and leave the caching policy with the default data disk caching policy. Let's see if that VM data disk has popped up yet. And I believe that's it right there, yep. So now I can initialize it. And now I can say create a new striped volume. And I can say add all of them. And I want to do a quick format on that. And then it's going to go ahead and convert that to a dynamic disk and quick format 16 terabyte data disk. So that's the way to get a monstrous disk on top. And why do we pick 16? Because nobody will ever need more than 16 terabytes is what we determined. Now to show you just graphically, again, we picked a very different approach than Amazon. Amazon's got Elastic Black Store, which is actually SAN-based storage, very different than S3. S3 is their blob and table and queue storage system that is really aimed at PaaS, REST APIs. EBS is for VHDs. The two don't mix. The APIs are different. Again, the EBS is kind of the Roach Motel. We built our VHDs directly on top of existing Windows Azure Storage, the same place that blobs, tables, and queues are implemented. In fact, these VHDs are stored as blobs in Windows Azure Storage. We get a bunch of benefits from this. One is that any performance improvements we make for VHDs and VMs automatically apply to PaaS workloads using blobs. Page blobs specifically is what we're using. Second, Windows Azure Storage is ubiquitous. It's in all our data centers. It's massively scaled out. We don't have two different storage stacks that we need to scale and manage independently. Third, Windows Azure Storage is highly, highly available. Every write that goes to Windows Azure Storage before it's acknowledged back to the client is triplicated on three different servers in three different fault domains. And I'll talk about fault domains in a minute. It means you can have multiple server failures and not lose access to your data. So the data is highly available. And that's also a little bit different than EBS. If you go read the fine print on EBS, it says it's highly durable, except maybe it's not. And if you look at any Amazon outage that affects EBS, almost always the recommendation is go to backups of your database and restore from there, because they could be corrupt. We honor flush and write through. So on this caching slide previously, that's for default IOs. But if a VM issues a write-through flag, which is what SQL Server does on its IOs that need to be transactionally consistent, those get committed directly, even if you're running SQL Server on the OS disk. So IOs coming out of an OS disk, flushes will flush the local caches. But all IOs that go back to Windows Azure Storage, which we call XStore, those are all committed before they're written. And I can show you those data disks for that 16 terabyte machine are sitting right here. This is a standard off-the-shelf storage exploring tool, Cloud Explorer, from Clumsy Leaf Software. It's our favorite in Windows Azure right now. This, unmodified, does not know about VHDs. And it just works on these VHDs. In fact, you want to see how fast it is to copy 1 terabyte up in the cloud? Or how awesome our Windows Azure Storage solution is. I just did a Control C. I'm going to do a Control V. How long do you think it'll take to copy that 1 terabyte from one folder to another up in the cloud? Either one.
2 seconds.
2 seconds? All right, let's see. Yeah, you were wrong. It's done. And that's because Windows Azure Storage actually uses copy on write for this. So you can actually make snapshots all day long, copy on write snapshots like that. I just made a virtual copy of that 1 terabyte disk. And then I can also download it. This tool also has downloaded. Of course, I don't have enough storage. No, you pay for the difference. You pay only for the copy on write, so you're not paying. So I don't have enough space to copy that. But you can. That's just to drive home the point of the benefits we get out of being on top of Windows Azure Storage. Talk about virtual machine availability now. So our SLA to you for Windows Azure Compute is 99.95% availability of a multi-instance role. This is the old PaaS language, which if you go read it, it'll say if you have at least 2 instances of a role behind the load balancer, so talking to the outside world, access to one of those instances, we guarantee 99.95% of the time. That means that 4.38 hours a year, we can screw up and we're still within SLA. Now, of course, our game is to not screw up at all. And if you go compare this SLA with what you get on EC2, EC2's SLA is actually, go read it carefully, because it's really vague. And when you finish it, it really doesn't seem like much of an SLA. It says you get 99.5, we guarantee 99.95% availability across multiple availability zones in the same region, at least 2 availability zones. What that means is that 2 availability zones that they had advertised to you, at least one of them will be available 99.95% of the time of the year. They say nothing about your servers, nothing about your virtual machines. There's no SLA on them, just around availability zones. So this actually is a little more precise here. Now, what's included in this SLA is, of course, unplanned and planned outages. So if switch fails in the data center, if a server fails in the data center, then that's what we cover behind that SLA. We'll recover from those kinds of problems if they impact both instances within that SLA period over the course of a whole year, less than 4.38 hours. What's not included, of course, is the time that you can't access your VMs because the VM's booting, so it's not accessible from the network, or you've just horked it because you're messing with the registry in a way that you shouldn't. And now you make your machine unbootable. Of course, that's not going to count toward, against the SLA.
How did that data center behave during the hurricane center?
I'll answer this question, but I can't really take questions because we only have 60 minutes, and so I've got to get through this material. How did their data center behave through Hurricane Sandy? Just awesome. Really, really proud of the data center behavior. So, actually, no, our data centers were unaffected, fortunately. We turned on the generator, standard procedure during in cases where we might lose power, we proactively turn on the generators just to make sure that failover happens seamlessly. But how is that discussion about those SLAs relate to virtual machines? Well, single instance, we don't offer an SLA. There's an implicit SLA if you think of two instances giving you 99.95 and do the math on that. That's 99.76% SLA on a single instance. So there is an implicit one. But we really don't advertise that. We say if you want to get an SLA, put your VMs into an availability set. And then you'll get the same 99.95 that you get if you're a PaaS role with at least two instances. Now, what's an availability set? Let's talk about that. To understand availability sets, you need to understand the concepts of fault domains and update domains. Now, a fault domain represents a unit, a group of resources, physical resources in the data center that represent a single point of failure, where a single failure of some resource can cause an outage for all of the associated resources. Today, that maps to a top-of-rack router in our data center. If a top-of-rack router fails, all of the servers on that rack lose their connectivity to the outside world. So we now map fault domains to racks. And update domains, though, are a concept around planned outages. Two kinds of planned outages. One is when you're rolling out an update to your platform as a service worker role, and those instances get automatically mapped into different update domains, we'll go ahead and orchestrate it so that your instances get taken down one update domain at a time, are allowed to do their updates, their code and config updates, come back up, report that they're healthy before we'll move automatically to the next update domain. So you'll never be completely unavailable during your own updates. Further, we do updates, planned updates of the data center itself. We update the host operating system underneath these virtual machines. You can guess about how often we do it, about once a month, to update with security and reliability and performance fixes. And we honor update domains through that process so the cloud services remain available while this is happening. In fact, many people don't even know we do this. Unless you're really monitoring your cloud service, you won't see your VMs getting rebooted across these incidents because your site will always be available. So when you take a look at fault and update domains with platform as a service, you automatically get put into fault domains and update domains when you create a role and you scale them out. So you can see I've got a web role with four instances. I've got a worker role with four instances. We'll map them onto at least two different racks, at least two, which are fault domains. And then you can see that we'll also then map update domains onto those fault domains so that they don't collide with each other. And when we go do now, when a rack fails, you'll see that half the service is still available so that we can then heal the other half. And that's where the 99.95% availability on unplanned outages comes from. And then for the planned ones, when we're updating servers, we won't take out more than one update domain at a time. So we might update the servers on the left and then wait for those to come back up and then update the servers on the right. For virtual machines, I've got these four virtual machines, two front ends, IIS front ends, and SQL Server back ends. I will put those into two different availability sets. The IIS front ends are stateless. The SQL servers are, of course, stateful. And so you need something like SQL mirroring. We'll also have SQL Server availability clustering coming soon. But today it's SQL Server mirroring. So you put those SQL servers and IIS machines in availability sets, and now they will get also mapped onto different racks in the data center in different fault domains and onto different update domains for those planned OS updates. So we'll never take out both of the front ends or both of the back ends at the same time. Let's see an example of that. I've got a cloud service here, which is completely of virtual machines. If I go to instances, you can see that it's got two virtual machines, which I've called Web Apps Manager, a SQL witness, and then I've got, I need to change the Zoomit color just because Zoomit's so much fun, to then the SQL Server backends. And when I scroll over, I can see the update and fault domains that these are mapped to. So you can see that Web Apps Manager 1 and Web Apps Manager 2, if I look at those together, they are in both different update domains as different fault domains. If I look at the SQL witness, well, it's not in an availability set with anybody. And if I look at the, what's a good color, red, there, I see that these are also in two different update domains and fault domains. And the reason why those are mapped that way is actually I've placed them that way. If I click on Web Apps Manager 1 and I go to configure, I see here that it's part of the Web AV set, availability set. And it's in there because with that other front end, because that other front end's also part of that same availability set. And that has directed the Fabric controller to place them in different racks. And I can show that to you here in this view right that I've got in the browser here. It's a diagnostic tool we use to look at data center allocation. It is showing us boxes for virtual machines on rectangles that represent servers that are organized in the rack topology that they're in the data center. This is actually running in one of our data centers where I've got this cloud service running, and I can go find it by copying its deployment ID. When you call in with the support case, you give us your deployment ID. We use tools like this to go figure out what's going on. So when I enter that, what shows up in green here are the virtual machines associated with this. And we can see that that cloud service has five virtual machines in it. There's three of them right there. And if I scroll down, there's another one right there, and here's another one right there. And they're all on different fault domains except for those two. What that tells me is these two right here are not part of the same availability set. They can't be because we would not place them that way. So they're neither on the same server nor on the same fault domains generally if they're even if they're on part of the same cloud service, just because we try to spread for a better availability than what we actually promise. And that SQL witness was one of the, could have been one of them, the SQL witness watching for failovers as well. Now let's talk about virtual networking. I mentioned that we needed to add some features to make it possible for existing server applications to run in Windows Azure. We, up until June, didn't have support for UDP in Windows Azure. Turns out, lots of Windows Server applications use UDP. So we needed to support UDP. We needed to give them full control over machine names. We needed to give server applications to be able to resolve each other through DNS. One of the benefits of platform as a service is you can create your own new APIs. And so for Windows Azure Web and Worker roles, the API, the runtime APIs we had allowed them to go find each other's IP addresses. You would say, get web role instances, and then you would call an API that said, give me its IP address, and the runtime would go figure that out. You wouldn't even know about the machine name behind that IP address or behind that web role instance. It's something you shouldn't have had to worry about. But for server applications, they look each other up by DNS name. So we needed to then bring DNS into Windows Azure and make it available to cloud services. We also wanted to make it possible for you to bring your own DNS server. So you're going to see that I've done that as well. I mentioned UDP. We also had to support other protocols, ICMP and dynamic ports as well, some other changes we had to make. The two features that I'm going to talk about next are port-forwarded endpoints as well as custom load balancer health probes. These are useful for virtual machines. Now, why are they useful for virtual machines? We today give you a single IP address for a cloud service. I mentioned it's kind of a network boundary, and you get one IP address. This has always been the case in Windows Azure. That IP address, then you can take ports of those IP address and map them to individual roles in a platform as a service world. Well, a virtual machine is a single instance role, so you can do the same thing. You can take a port on the load balancer IP address, which we call a VIP, a virtual IP address, and then map it to a local port on a particular role or virtual machine. And that is one way to go directly to a particular virtual machine. We expose this now. We used to just be map it to a role, but we needed to get down to virtual machines, and so that's where we introduced port forwarding. When you, for example, want to RDP into a virtual machine that's part of a cloud service, like I did when I RDP'd into this 10, 16-terabyte machine. Well, I've only got one IP address for those two VMs that are part of that Build 2020 service that has two virtual machines in it. So how am I able to RDP into a particular one? Back in the platform, if you have a web and worker role scenario, what we do is we stick in a RDP plugin forwarder that into those virtual machines that then takes the incoming RDP request and then goes and routes it to the appropriate machine inside of the cloud service. One of our principles was no need for an agent inside these virtual machines. You can just take a stock virtual machine and put it up here. No need for an agent. That means we need to be able to route directly to it from the outside. And that's where port forwarding comes into play. When I click on the 16-terabyte machine and I go to endpoints, I can see that I've got one endpoint mapped from the VIP. And I've called it RDP. It's actually created automatically when you create a VM in the portal. It's protocol TCP. The public port on the VIP is 5855. The private port on the virtual machine is 3389, which is the standard RDP port. So now to RDP to this virtual machine, I RDP to the DNS name, the public DNS name of that VIP, or the public IP address of that VIP, and specify port 5855, and I'll get routed to that RDP endpoint and RDP into the machine. When you say connect to, you're getting an RDP file that's already configured to do that. And you can see that it's not load balanced as well. I'll show you RDPing into or SSHing into that Linux test. So I have to say virtual machine, and whichever one of these is not the, it's the other one. It's not part of the cloud service. And I can SSH into it by doing this. And using a little SSH tool. And by default, for the first Linux VM that you create that's in in a cloud service, you'll automatically, the public VIP port will be 22, so you don't have to worry about it. If you create another now Linux VM and attach it to the same cloud service, it'll get a different SSH port on the VIP to distinguish it. But for the first one, it maps to 22. And then that will also be the case for RDP on the first Windows machine as well. But right now, you will get a random VIP port for the first virtual machine, Windows virtual machine, to talk to RDP. So now I'm RDPing into that virtual machine. Let me RDP into the other one here while I'm at it, because I want to demonstrate something else about virtual networking. So you can see this one's 65082, because it wasn't the first virtual machine as part of that cloud service. 65082. And now I've got two, one into that one that's part of a cloud service and one that's with that other virtual machine and one that's not. We'll come back to that. You can create load balance sets as well. Remember, with web roles, when you take a VIP and you map it to a role in the platform as a service world, then the load balancer will automatically spray requests across those instances so that if one instance dies, the rest get the traffic. You can do that now with virtual machines as well using what we call load balance sets. Take that same concept of grouping machines behind the load balancer, add virtual machines to a load balance set, and now the load balancer will spray across them. And that's what we've had to do with that front end in that Web Apps Manager application, because we've got two front ends, Web Apps Manager 1 and 2. If I go to the endpoints, I can look at the web front end, which I want to be load balanced, and you can see here web TCP, the public port is 80, the internal port is 80, because there's no need to do a port forwarding for this, because we want that public port 80 to go to any of these web apps managers, and you can see that it's load balanced. I can say edit endpoint, and you can see, you can see that it's load balanced because it's part of a load balanced set called web, and I've added the other instance to this, the other virtual machine to this. So now these are behind the load balancer. If one of them goes down, the load balancer will automatically detect it's offline, and it's doing that by probing the port 80 there by default and waiting for an OK back from it. doing a get on it. But if you want to have a different health model, you can also create custom load balancer probes. I don't have one set up on those virtual machines, but you can say, I don't want you to probe port 80 because that's where I want my web traffic to go. I want you to probe my health port, the one that is like telling me if this machine is healthy. So you can specify the probe port, the probe path, and then you can also, which is a specific URL off the website. If you did want to say port 80, but go hit health.asx, and that's where I'm going to have my code automatically reply or not if the site's healthy or if the virtual machine's healthy. And it'll look back for an HTTP 200. So that's also part of the load balance features. The final of our networking feature I want to talk about is called VNet, or virtual networking, and virtual network gateway. We introduced about a year and a half ago, or 2 years ago, something codenamed Sydney called Windows Azure Connect that would let you put an agent on a machine on-premise, an agent in a virtual machine in the cloud, and they would create a secure IPv6 tunnel between them. So you could then talk from on-premise network up into the cloud. You could domain join machines that way, for example. This is not the traditional way that enterprise IT manages networks, by going and sticking agents on all their boxes. In fact, if you wanted to domain join one of these machines in the cloud, you need to put the Sydney agent on your domain controller, which enterprise IT administrators don't want to put anything anywhere near their domain controllers. So we implemented virtual Azure networking with Gateway as a standard VPN solution, which enterprises know and love. And there's two ways that you can use this feature. One of them is the primary scenario, which is the hybrid IT scenario, where I want to bridge my on-premise network up into the cloud network so those machines feel like they're on my local subnets. And then the second is I want to create a virtual network overlay in the cloud, which will give me a control of IP addresses. So I can have basically static IP addresses now assigned to my virtual machines in the cloud. And I also can connect virtual machines from different cloud services together so that they can talk to each other, because by default, they can't. So when a cloud service is an implicit network boundary, so for example, this Linux VM, which isn't part of that cloud service, can't see this 16 terabyte machine. The 16 terabyte machine, if I do ping, you'll see that it doesn't know who the hell it is. And that's because IDNS doesn't extend. And even if I pinged its internal IP address, which you can get from the portal, it wouldn't be able to ping it. Over on this one, though, it resolves. That name resolves, and I get back an internal IP address, which, again, would match what I see in the portal. Now, the reason that the ping isn't working is I've got the firewall turned on, just because, let's see if this reconnects. And if I open the firewall here, you'll see that the pings start flowing. And that's because it's part of the same cloud service, so it's part of the same implicit VNet, really, of that cloud service, part of the trusted boundary. But you can take, like I said, arbitrary VMs and put them inside of a cloud, multiple cloud services, you can put them inside of a VNet. We've actually put all of the that events manager VMs inside of a VNet as well. And we did that because we create a gateway too that allows us to connect to an on-premise server through a VPN device on-premise. That events manager app that we've been looking at is architected exactly that way. When I go to Fabricam apps, cloud apps, this thing is part of a VNet. And you can see I've mapped different subnets of that VNet to different tiers in that application. Where's that VNet defined? It's over here in the virtual networks tab. It's called at VNet. I click on it, and I can see, this on-premise thing is sitting under somebody's desk in an office in a few buildings over. So I hope he might have kicked it or something after lunch, or he's just messing with me. But this was working before. I'll see if it reconnects. Unfortunately, illustratively, those machines are domain joined to an Active Directory domain controller that is sitting under, oh, there we go, sitting under that guy's desk behind that VPN gateway. And how can we get to it? It's really kind of cool because I'm going to tunnel into the machine under his desk through the cloud, through that gateway right here. The way that I'm going to do that is if I go to configure, this will show me the DNS servers. That Active Directory domain controller is also serving as the DNS server for that cloud service. So when I select that IP address, that is an IP address. You can see it's a 192 private IP address. It's not a Windows Azure IP address. It's one sitting in that CorpNet. And when I go and go to the Web Apps Manager, which I've RDP'd into, I can RDP into that IP address there. And what I'm doing is now connecting to that machine under his desk. And you can see I've got Active Directory users and computers set up. Here you can see Web Apps Manager 1, Web Apps Manager 2. There's the SQL servers. There's the SQL witness. And I've also got other machines and other cloud services in other that we haven't looked at, SharePoint form, sitting up there also in the cloud. And here's the Cisco VPN device management tool. And you can see right here, this is the rule that routes between the gateway address, the Windows Azure gateway address, which we've given the customer, or in this case us, a configuration file that you download that has that gateway IP address. And there you can see the remote network's Windows Azure network. And that's what allows me to RDP and to domain join. In fact, when I go to that application, that front end, Fabricam Cloud Apps, and I connect to it by going to the front end, this thing is set up to log me in. This is Events Manager IIS website, ASP.NET website, that is doing authentication to that domain controller for my account on that domain. And what this will also do is show me how this thing is configured, both for who it's talking to as far as the SQL Server database, as well as its machine name. And this is will be clear why I chose to expose this stuff in this app in a minute. Because down here, you can see that the machine name is Web Apps Manager 2. That's the host name we gave this virtual machine. You can see that it's talking to, as far as its connection string that's sitting in the web config, it's sitting there and connecting to both of that the SQL mirrors. So if one fails, it'll then reconnect to the other one. So that's the power of VNet. Now, like I said, we believe in PaaS is the future. And we didn't want to create two distinct worlds, like a DOS world and a Win32 world that didn't mix together, where you write apps that are, we consider virtual machines like DOS, by the way, and Win32, which are like PaaS, the powerful, easy, the details get covered for you world. We wanted to make those seamlessly connect so that as the applications develop, as you enhance the applications, invest in them, and migrate them to PaaS and scale out in statelessness, as the features of external stores like SQL Azure grow to fulfill the needs of your applications, you can start migrating from an IaaS world to a PaaS world, of course, at your own pace, focusing on the things that you consider important to bring to the future. But to do that, we needed to make the two worlds blend together. So this is the marketing slide about why PaaS is better. It's faster, it's cheaper, it tastes great, it's less filling, it's everything, and it costs less than $6 million. And IaaS and PaaS side by side lets you take that migration. There's a few different ways today that you can connect IaaS and PaaS together. Today you cannot put virtual machines, IaaS virtual machines, in the same cloud service as PaaS roles. That's something we're going to be working on. So in the meantime, there's two different ways that you can connect PaaS and IaaS. One is by connecting them through their VIPs. And so in this model, this architecture right here, we've got the front ends, those web manager front ends, stateless IaaS. We can migrate those into WebRoll really easy. In fact, I'll show you how easy it is to migrate a standard ASP.NET website into a WebRoll. I right-click and I say, add Windows Azure Cloud Service Project. And that's exactly what I've done previously to this Web Events Manager app. Now, to this Events Manager app, I've had to set the cloud configuration to have it be part of that VNet. And I actually can do that right here, show you just how easy it is to add this to a VNet. If I press Enter, and I've got a snippet set up here. And there's the code to add it to that VNet and put it in that front end, exactly what I've previously done. So now that I've got that front end in a web role, I can deploy that. And I've got that sitting right here, this web app cloud service. If I go to instances, you can see the names are different. These are PaaS assigned names. Events.web instance 0 and 1, automatically assigned to me. And if I go and hit that URL for this, it's going to look exactly the same as what we saw, because it's the exact same code. And I log into it, it's still, because it's part of VNet, authenticating me with that domain controller. In this case, it'll show us a different machine name. It's going to be a Windows Azure assigned machine name. I didn't have to worry about assigning it one, because I don't care in this case for PaaS. So that'll come up here in a second after it logs in. And you can see RD, blah, blah, blah. RD stands for Red Dog. That was the original Windows Azure code name. That's what the machine names are still prefixed with up in the cloud. You can see that it's still talking to that SQL Server database. The benefits of this now, it's now I've basically connected stateless PaaS front ends with the stateful SQL back end, and I've done it through virtual IP addresses. So I've configured that front end to talk to the SQL Server VIP of that cloud service and the SQL Server ports on that VIP. The advantages of this is now I can manage those independently. I can deploy and update the cloud services independently. The downsides are that I get a little bit of higher latency because now I'm going through the public load balancer. So that adds about half a millisecond of latency to the traffic going through there. It's a little less secure because now I've got this VIP sitting on the open internet. Of course, I can assign firewall rules to only allow traffic in from my front ends, but it's still sitting on the open internet. Somebody can hammer it. And I have the additional management overhead of deploying two cloud services. I can also connect them with VNets. So this case, they can be connected directly together, not going through the public front ends. They can be talking directly to an internal load balancer if they want. The weaknesses of this is that there's more complexity with setting up the VNets to span cloud services, and I've got to worry about subnets. And there's no Windows Azure provided DNS across VNets in different cloud services. That's going to be fixed as well. We're working on that feature. And then finally, there's mixed PaaS and IaaS in the same cloud service. This will be coming in the future. And then at the end of the road, after you've taken that SQL backend, you've migrated the SQL data into SQL Azure, and SQL Azure does what you need it to do. In this case, it does everything this website needs it to do. You can migrate completely to PaaS. And that's as simple as, in this case, changing the connection string in web-events.config to point at a SQL Azure connection string, web config. So there's a connection string up here for the failover partners. I can then create a SQL Azure database, connect to it, and that's what I've done as well and deployed that as well. And that is sitting right here. And this now will look exactly the same, except it's still VNet joined to talk to the AD, but it's fully PaaS talking to SQL Azure Storage, so we'll see a Red Dog machine name, and we'll see a SQL Azure connection string in the bottom of the web page as it comes up here. And there it is. There's my SQL Azure connection string. So that's kind of the steps we imagine people taking as they migrate from IaaS world to the PaaS world. And so that brings me to the conclusion of the session. These are the key points we wanted to nail when we started out with this project. We believe that we've delivered a cohesive end-to-end solution, and we've validated this all along the way with partners, with customers, people coming into what we call software design reviews, working with key partners that have launched with us, partners like RightScale we've worked very closely with to validate everything we're doing from the APIs to the whole feature set making sense and people really wanting to do the enterprise things you want to do. We actually have white papers on how to set up a SharePoint form in Windows Azure that you can go follow, kind of a recipe to do that. So I think that we've got a very compelling release, and this is, I mentioned some things we've got coming. So we are, we know that there's gaps where we can make life easier, and we're going to be filling those over time. We're still in preview. We're going to release to GA, again, once we feel confident that the performance, the reliability, the availability, and the end-to-end features all make sense to everybody. We're on track like we hoped. Everything is, all systems are green right now, so look for it in the not too very distant future. And in the meantime, everybody please look under your chairs. No, just kidding. I just always wanted to say that. But So for that, thank you very much. Please fill out an eval, and I'll see you tomorrow afternoon. I'll be giving a Windows Azure Internals talk.